This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, good morning.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Same to you. As you know, I've been doing this program for over 20 years, and today's topic is something that we never really tackled head on, and that's a problem, because it's a problem that happens more than you think, more than it should.
Yes.
In the United States, it is estimated that over 1 million people, now that's an estimate, commit or attempt suicide every year, and over 38,000 people actually commit suicide. It's one of the leading causes of death of America's teenagers. It's in the top five of the list of things that kill teenagers. And it's probably strange that we don't hear more about it, considering what a big problem it is. It's a tragic reaction in most instances to some sort of stressful life situation. All the more tragic because what we'll learn today and what we all should know is that suicide in most instances can be prevented.
Yes. Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with two psychiatrists and suicide prevention experts, Dr. Timothy Lineberry and Dr. Michael Bostwick. We'll talk about the impact of suicide and suicide-related behaviors and discuss the dramatic increase in suicide among members of the military. We'll find out what might lead you to suspect that someone you know might be considering suicide and what you can do and what you should do about it. Plus, we'll talk about what the family members and loved ones should do once they have lost someone to suicide.
All good information. So let's meet today's guest, psychiatrists, both of them, Dr. Tim Lineberry. Dr. Lineberry, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Tom, thank you for having us.
Yep. And Dr. Michael Bostwick. Dr. Bostwick, welcome.
I appreciate being here.
So, Dr. Lineberry, let's start with you. This is obviously one of life's, a tragedy of life, but it is something that we should talk about, right?
No, suicide is an important problem. And I think the concern that we have from a public health standpoint, just for individuals, is that there are many things we can do to help people who are suffering with psychiatric illness and thinking about suicide. So it's absolutely vital that we talk about suicide prevention and how to get people help and to fight the stigma of suicide.
It is true. Is it a true statement that most of the time, if you're aware of the warning signs, that this can be prevented?
It can be. It is challenging because I'm sure there are people who are listening right now who've lost someone to suicide and didn't see the warning signs. But our hope is that by identifying those warning signs for the public, that people can get help when they need to get help.
Isn't that one of the biggest problems for the loved ones that are left, is that they feel like they should have done something, that they could have done something, that it is in some part their fault?
It is a significant issue, and there's so much guilt associated with losing someone by suicide. And the fact that it happens to young people or people who were healthy at that moment or that you didn't see signs is a really big issue for families.
So, Dr. Bostwick, is the family a part of this whole scenario that you often deal with after the event? Do most families need some kind of help afterwards?
Well, I think absolutely that people need help, not necessarily professional help, but if you think of any death in any family, it's a traumatic event, and then you think of a death in which someone has taken their own life, taken matters into their own hands, it's that much more traumatic. Professionals certainly are available and can help, so can religious figures, so can other family members and neighbors and friends. By, in many cases, simply not being judgmental, but being supportive and available.
And what sort of help is that? Is it in the form of talk therapy, or are there medications available, or how do you deal with the family?
Well, first of all, for medications, you'd have to decide that there was some sort of psychiatric problem that would respond to medications that had developed. Talking, I think, is where it's at. Sorting out the story, trying to make sense of what happened, trying to allay guilt, if it's there, make sense of what's gone on. One of the things that I think is very important is that suicide is a violation of the social contract, and in many cases it's a choice that the individual who died made, and not something that the people who survived did.
Violation of a social contract.
I think our understanding is that as humans, we do not be killing ourselves generally. We stay alive for each other until something larger than us takes us from the earth.
Can we start with teenagers? Is suicide different for teenagers? Are the risks different? Are the symptoms different? How is it different for teens than for adults?
You know, as we look at teens, if you look at the leading causes of death with teens, it's accidents, homicide, and suicide are typically the three leading causes. In terms of suicide with teens, what we do see is that teens may be more impulsive in terms of their attempts. Suicide in all age groups is often associated with a significant stressor and other problems with that. We do see a significant association with depression, substance abuse, and psychiatric illness. So in some ways, it's not as different, but that impulsivity and the fact that it may happen so much more quickly related to a stressor compared to adults.
Because they don't have life experiences to gauge it against.
And that's exactly right.
One of the things I think is so sad when I hear it, and it specifically for teens, but also for other adults, maybe for women, so I'm a little bit more touchy about it, is that you hear someone say, well, they didn't really want to commit suicide. It was just a cry for help. This is when a suicide is attempted, but not the person doesn't die. Yeah. Diminishing in some way the pain that that person was feeling, maybe they really didn't want to die. But what is the difference there?
From my standpoint, I actually don't differentiate because I don't think it helps.
Right.
The reality is that somebody needs help. And so if you have a suicide attempt or someone saying, I'm trying to get help, you need that help. And so I don't worry about that as much. I do think there's my personal concern is that that stigmatizes the person getting help and also the actions, and it implies some weakness with it, that it wasn't serious or it wasn't important. And from that standpoint, my preference is that we just kind of, it is what it is. It's a suicide attempt, and somebody does need help.
There are a lot more attempts at suicide than people who actually end up carrying it out, right? And do we have a figure? Do we know how many people are successful, if you will?
I think that successful in the attempt actually is one of the challenges with kind of the words that we've come up with to describe that. But in terms of kind of how many people think about suicide and how common suicide attempts are, that information's been hard to get. We've typically gone from people who've gotten help in emergency departments. And so those estimates may range from 750,000 to 1 million people. Beginning around 2008, we actually started asking in the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. So that's that survey where it comes out and you find out how many people are using drugs, other parts. But how common are serious thoughts of suicide? And they're surprisingly common. Over 3 million people think about ending their lives each year.
3 million.
3 million.
Dr. Bostwick, any comment?
No. Luckily, I think that many of the things people try to do to harm themselves don't, in fact, kill them. And it's important to remember that behaviors that fall into the spectrum of suicide are not all lethal, although they are signs of distress. When Tracy made the comment earlier about ways of showing that you're in trouble, you might punch a wall, you might hit your child, you might throw something, or you might harm yourself. And so there's a whole collection of ways in which people demonstrate that they're in terrible pain, and all of them deserve a response.
And I think with that, you know, as we talk about those numbers, 1 million, 3 million, it really is that idea of the tip of the iceberg, because there are people struggling with depression, anxiety, other problems, coping, who may not have thoughts of suicide, but those same warning signs, and getting people help can make a difference. So if we think at a larger level, getting people help is absolutely critical.
You know, we were talking about the risk factors for suicide, and particularly with regard to teenagers, and I don't think I heard you mention bullying, but that's been in the news recently, and that's certainly a risk factor, correct?
There's not a lot of data with that, and so there's some confusion. I do think, actually, from the data that we do have, those who are bullied and those who are bullying are both at higher risk for suicide. It's challenging to tease out kind of what the impact is because we don't have as much data with that. Clearly, how you feel about yourself, stressors with that, whether you then have depression or other associated problems, whether you're substance using, make a difference. I do think there clearly have been very high-profile cases nationally and talked about in the media extensively related to bullying with child and adolescent suicide in particular.
It's tricky to draw that correlation because some kids who are bullied end up, you know, hurting others or acting out or committing suicide. And some teenagers who commit suicide do so not because they were bullied. So the correlation is off. Dr. Boswick?
I would also argue that bullying is the subject du jour of the media at the moment. I remember when I was in high school a good many decades ago that bullying was very common. And then in some cases, it was regarded as how you grew up. You were shaped by the bullying that happened. Mm-hmm. So, in a sense, life is brutal. I also would throw in sort of hopefully that we don't know who we save. That with suicide, when you're dead is dead, but if you survive your suicide attempt or survive your thoughts, we don't necessarily know that. Right. So that all the efforts that we make to prevent depression or to treat depression, to prevent substance abuse, all these different things show up without a crime because we did the prevention work.
You know, I also found it interesting on the list of risk factors for teenagers was pregnancy and having a sexually transmitted disease.
You know, with that, as we look at risk factors, I think they're really, you know, as Dr. Boswick kind of brought up, they're really markers of risk in terms of kind of what things are going on and adversity. So, as we identify those, for kids who are at risk or struggling, they may be more at risk for suicide. I do think, as we talk about things, we talk a lot about risk factors, but many of the things that we're looking for are really getting down to the individual issues.
Stressors.
Yes.
Yep. Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk more with psychiatrists and suicide prevention experts, Dr. Timothy Lineberry and Dr. Michael Bostwick, plus myth or matter of fact, suicides peak during the holidays.
Matter of fact. Yeah, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions at 507-282-1234. You can go to our website, too, radio.mayoclinic.org, and post a question there. Or tweet us your question anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and today's guests, both psychiatrists and suicide prevention experts, Dr. Timothy Lineberry, Dr. Michael Bostwick. So we have talked about some of the risk factors for both adults and teenagers when it comes to suicide. But the question I want to ask is, if you are a parent and you are the parent of a teenage son or daughter, what might you look for or what might you see in a child and a teenager that would make you suspect that they have suicidal tendencies?
This gets to that idea of warning signs and what to look for. And so the things that we look for are often signs of depression, so changes in behavior, not sleeping as much or sleeping too much, feeling sad, crying, just not being the kind of person that they have been.
And, personality changes?
Yeah, personality changes and just a change in the way they the sleep, the energy, concentration, difficulties in school, substance abuse or misuse in a way that wasn't there before.
Is that similar then with adults?
It is similar.
Take away the school part, but yeah. Concentrating on work.
Yeah, no, it's very similar with adults. And these are really kind of the warning signs. So those are the things that you can look for and react to. And I think one of the questions that always comes up with warning signs gets back to that idea of the social contract that Dr. Bostwick spoke to, is that it's incredibly uncomfortable to ask someone about thoughts of suicide. And so one of the things that we know is that asking about thoughts of suicide doesn't make someone suicidal. And actually, kind of in a counter way, it actually may be helpful because that person struggling with the thoughts, which are clearly not something that are socially acceptable or usual, and they may be very frightening to that individual. So asking about it may actually help and identify the problem.
And what are the words that you use? What exactly do you say to your teenager?
Are you having thoughts about killing yourself?
You should confront it head on.
Yeah. Are you thinking about suicide? Have you had those thoughts? Are you safe? And I think along with that really kind of the question, well, what do I do then? And really that's about being supportive, listening, And identifying kind of resources to get help. And we've created some things to help with that at a larger national level, too.
And we can put those links on our webpage for folks who are interested. During the commercial break, you said something that I thought, that's a great point. Once you decide that you want to commit suicide or that you are feeling suicidal, it doesn't mean that then you're in the red zone for the rest of your life. You have times that are worse than others, and in that moment, you are suicidal.
Yes, I think it's helpful to think of it as a suicidal crisis, and that there are elements that go into that crisis. For example, being intoxicated might raise your risk because you're more likely to do dumb things when you're intoxicated. Having broken up with a loved one, having lost a lot of money, having had something devastating happen that seems like the end of the world at that moment, but it will pass. It will get better. That's where wisdom from someone you're speaking to can help. It's also where speaking very directly to the matter can perhaps make a difference. I was thinking, as Dr. Shives was asking about how hard it is to talk about sex, another famous topic for people talking indirectly around the matter or not at all. Well, probably it's best when you're talking to your teen about sex to talk about sex. Mm-hmm. And when you're thinking about suicide yourself, to share the fact that you're thinking about it with the person you're worried about can be very relieving because it's an invitation to talk. And the way that you diffuse a crisis is, in fact, to diffuse it. And acutely, it won't be an antidepressant. It'll be a conversation. It'll be putting the guns away. It'll be watching somebody, sitting with them, calling in resources, bringing in the church if necessary, reassuring them that whatever has gone on, you can help with it so they aren't stuck with it by themselves. There are many, many things that we can do that are simply practical responses. But the first thing and the most important thing is to establish interpersonally between the two of us that the person is actually thinking that they might want to end it over something that's probably highly fixable with some help.
Being a parent isn't easy, is it?
Well, but being, certainly, but also being the friend of someone or the family member of someone who is going through this, I think they just feel so much of that burden of this person died because of me, or this person needs help, and I am the only one who can help them, whether the person has died or not.
And that responsibility, I think part of that is collaborative, and it gets to what Dr. Bostwick talked about, in that it's talking openly about that. And when we look at kind of managing a crisis, there really are parts that are practical about cutting out stressors for at least a period of time to get people safe, being in a safe place, restricting access so that somebody can't hurt themselves. It's either safe storage of a gun or removal.
Temporary removal, you said during the Twitter chat, yeah. I remember.
And with that, really keeping things safe so that if you think about a crisis and then harm, it's what gets that person to that next point and being able to do that.
Teens are at greatest risk for suicide. Myth or matter of fact?
Myth. The statistics, and I think statistics don't really capture the complexity and the tragedy of suicide. So I think that's always one of the challenges with whatever we talk about suicide, and as we're doing that today. But for teens, suicide rates have not changed over the past decade. At the same time, if you look at kind of causes of death with teens, it is a serious issue in terms of cause of death. If we look at groups just based on age and particular things, it's males and since the Great Recession or the economic crisis, what we've seen is an increase in suicide rates in middle-aged men. And we think a lot of that is related to jobs and your sense of worth and the factors associated with that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, older individuals. Aren't they the highest risk group?
They have been, typically. But what we've seen in the context of kind of changes with jobs has been a change with that recently. So if you had asked us 5 or 6 years ago, we would have said, those over 65 are at the highest risk in terms of men.
Also, what has happened recently is the number of military suicides. And if there's something that's getting a lot of hyped media coverage, it would be that. But it's not unwarranted, correct?
No, our concerns with the military are very real. We've seen a change in the suicide rate in the military. Typically, suicide rates in the military have been lower than the general population, and there's reasons for that because of selection, being able to get into the military, everyone's working, and the support systems available. But we've seen over time and kind of gradually building with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, an increase in the rate of suicide now that's higher in the military compared to age-matched and gender-matched U.S. population.
Suicides peak during the holidays, myth or matter of fact?
It's really a myth. Actually, probably they peak after the holidays, if they peak at all.
Yeah.
There's a quality of living for the holidays, living beyond the holidays. I mean, one of the things that I think that we need to keep in mind here is that these statistics are population level statistics. And for folks of you out there who are listening, there's only one of you or a family of you. So statistics inform us very broadly. They're risk factors, but their risk factors apply to populations, not to individual people. Those are for the warning signs. And I think for purposes of suicide prevention, we look to what's happening in an individual family or an individual situation. Certainly if someone is depressed and talking about suicide and it happens to be December 24th, then you pay attention. But it's probably not the holiday that brought it on per se. It could have been any other day of the year they were in crisis.
What about weekends versus weekdays?
You know, I'm not sure that level of granularity is helpful, dare I say it.
Yeah, no, it really gets down to a lot of the questions we have and kind of just trying to understand how can this possibly happen. But there really is no one type of suicide, and there is no one particular cause for suicide.
All right, our guest, psychiatrist Dr. Timothy Lineberry, Dr. Michael Bostwick. Our topic is suicides and suicide prevention. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. Right after that, we'll be taking your phone calls, 507-282-1234. Your comments and questions from our website, radio.mayoclinic.org.
And your tweets, of course, at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Knee replacements. For many people with rheumatoid arthritis, knee replacements can help relieve pain and restore function. But should you have both knees done at the same time? Researchers from the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York found same-day bilateral knee replacement surgery is safe for certain patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Now, the researchers say people with rheumatoid arthritis are more likely to have other medical conditions than are people with wear and tear or osteoarthritis, and this can bring about complications during surgery. So that's why many have their knees done in separate operations. But this research shows getting both knees replaced at the same time is safe for the right patient. And now, having a big belly has consequences beyond trouble squeezing into your pants. It's bad for your health, even if you have a healthy body mass index, or BMI. A Mayo Clinic study found that men and women with large waist circumferences were more likely to die younger and were more likely to die from illnesses such as heart disease, respiratory problems, and cancer. Here's Mayo Clinic Dr. James Serhan.
What's a little newer here, maybe a little less recognized, is that even a greater waist circumference in the normal body mass index range, where people would say, oh, well, you're normal, you don't have to worry, we actually saw elevated risks occurring there. So this applies across the BMI spectrum, not just at the high ends. If you already have low BMI or low waist circumference, then the goal would be to maintain that over your life course. If you have a high BMI, and particularly a high waist circumference, then the first issue should be, well, we don't want it to get larger because there's incremental health risks. And even if you can make a small decrease, there's actually strong health benefits for that. So you don't necessarily have to go back to the very low levels, but even losing some belly fat, and that's usually through changes in diet and physical activity, will have important health benefits.
And this was published in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings. And now, when you have sore muscles, a fever, a headache, what do you reach for? Many of us grab a commonly used pain reliever. Well, a new study shows common pain relievers known as NSAIDs are also thought to be able to kill bacteria. Researchers say this discovery could open new strategies for fighting drug-resistant infections and so-called superbugs. Now, they didn't test the NSAIDs in aspirin, ibuprofen, and naproxen to get over the counter, but the NSAIDs they did test resulted in good news in the fight against potentially dangerous bugs. And this study was published in the journal Chemistry and Biology. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back, Mayo Clinic Radio. We are on air, online, and also you can pick us up anywhere on iHeartRadio. Time for you to join our conversation. Our telephone number 507-282-1234. Our topic is suicide and suicide prevention. We are with two Mayo Clinic experts, psychiatrist Dr. Timothy Lineberry and Dr. Michael Bostwick.
You can contact us also by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can tweet us, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We did get a couple of tweets, and one of them saying, I credit one of the Mayo nurses, this must be from someone here in town, or at any of the campuses, I guess, for making me come in the day that I called for help instead of waiting. She said, you're so sad I wouldn't feel right making you wait so long. So me worrying about her feelings made me go in for help. That has to be a Midwesterner. Is that right, Dr. Lineberry?
No, I think, and part of this gets down to the idea of concern and being there and open and listening and ensuring that somebody gets the help they need.
And when we talk about help, let's first of all talk about emergency help. If someone is thinking about suicide or a parent sees that their child is thinking about suicide, what can they do in an emergency situation?
So in an emergency situation, there are a number of options. So one of them is obviously contacting your doctor and the person that you're working with. You can contact someone of religious faith or going to the emergency department if needed to get that help. So we look at these crises, and again, what Dr. Bostwick spoke to, the suicidal crises, as an emergency and something that need to be addressed and taken care of.
And there is a suicide hotline, correct?
Yes. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it's manned or staffed by trained crisis center personnel. There's also a specific National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, if you're a veteran, that you can press the number and they will get you hooked up with the people staffing the Veterans National Suicide Prevention Lifeline
we'll
as well.
Put all those links on our webpage at radio.mayoclinic.org as well.
It's 800-273-TALK, correct?
Yes, sir.
And if you are a veteran, it's 1-800-273-TALK.
And one? I believe press 1.
Press 1.
Interesting.
Yeah.
During the break, Dr. Bostwick, you said we're bouncing back and forth between prevention and postvention. And certainly the people who have lost someone to suicide are hurting. That's where postvention comes in.
That's right. It's important that on the one hand, we want to prevent people in crisis from going all the way to suicide. I like very much the comment from the woman who valued her nurse, because it's a bit like chest pain. If a person was complaining of chest pain, you would send them to the hospital. You would get them help. Now, we're also mixing in questions about people who have survived the loss of a loved one. That's the postvention piece. And the resources are somewhat different. If you have a person in an acute crisis who may be about to harm themselves, you're going to get them one kind of help. If you're trying to come to terms with the loss of someone important to you, that's another kind of help. I also want to emphasize that in the prevention stage, it's a group effort. You're trying to really help that person get through something. But in the postvention stage, I do think it's helpful to recognize that on some level, that person who's dead made a bad choice. But they made a choice. You didn't do it. You didn't cause it. You didn't make it happen in most cases. There's a tendency when someone is dead to want to take responsibility for it as if you could bring them back or as if you could somehow get through it or beyond it by taking responsibility and explaining it.
You take on some of what their decision was, that it's not all on the person who's dead. It was not all their fault. It was somewhat my fault, too.
Well, and in my experience, that actually tends to prolong the grief and make it hard to get beyond it, because in a sense, you're not giving that person the right to have made a horrible choice, but a choice they made. You're trying to figure out how you could have done something after the fact, and at that point, it's time to figure out how to get through it and beyond it rather than to continue to marinate in it. I've met people who've essentially made their life's work to marinate in trying to explain a death of a loved one.
Is the grieving process following a suicide different than the grieving process that occurs after a child died for another reason? Because of an injury or an illness? Or?
Oh, I think absolutely. Again, because of the sense that nature didn't do it, I did it, the child did it. It's, again, outside that social contract we spoke of.
Or you're the child of someone who committed suicide. I mean, you can flip that any way around.
And it gets to the horrible, in some ways, complexity of losing someone by suicide, because here's somebody who is there and it's dying because of other things, potentially me.
Sure.
And there's that concern that both I missed the warning signs, or I didn't act, or I should have, and kind of a review of absolutely everything you've done. As Dr. Bostwick notes, though, there are aspects of grief that are the same. And there are a number of resources nationally and locally to provide information on loss of someone by suicide. So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a number of support groups. That's www.afsp.org, and then also the American Association of Suicidology. And we can get those web links for you. But they have a lot of information related to both the information associated with the loss of someone by suicide, what we know, as well as others who are suffering through it and can provide support.
We're taking your phone calls, questions and comments, 507-282-1234. If you would like to join in the conversation, myth or matter of fact, we popped this one up on Facebook. Most suicide attempts fail. And this question makes both of you kind of squirm whenever we've talked about it this morning. So why do you not like this one, Dr. Bostwick?
Well, I'd prefer it in the exactly the opposite. Most suicide attempts don't succeed.
Okay.
Failure implies that we're trying to get an A in killing ourselves, as opposed to, I'd rather we all got Fs in killing ourselves. Again, I think that the term suicide is used very broadly to describe a whole lot of distressing things that go on in people's lives. It's, I think, better to think of looking for distress and trying to help with it, and not speaking of a failed suicide attempt. It's more a positive sign of someone who's really upset and you want to help them, and they're still here alive to do it.
No, but by the way, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but where did that word come from? We all know it from very early on, but where's the word suicide come from?
I believe it's from one of the classical languages about killing, kaido, the self, sui, and that's the word. So it's a very it's a very fundamental term. But what I'm referring to now, you'll encounter people who harm themselves when they're stressed. They don't necessarily want to be dead, but they do harm themselves, and if they do it wrong or they do it too much, then they die.
It's almost like we've talked in the past, the big C. Nobody wants to say the word cancer, and I think we've gotten to the point now where folks can say cancer and you're okay. Suicide is kind of the same word. When you'll say suicide, it kind of, there's a pause and people don't want to even talk about it.
Well, and I'll go one step further. I once heard a lecture by someone talking about dizziness, and a doctor, and he said, dizzy, what do you mean dizzy? And my reaction to suicide is, suicide, what do you mean suicide? To try to get at the story that's underlying the distress that person is experiencing. Again, we hear about political suicides, we hear about altruistic suicides, we hear about suicides of people who are depressed and upset. The common theme in all of it is depressed and upset people or people who are making a statement, and you want to figure out, well, what's driving it? Is it the substance abuse that Dr. Lineberry mentioned? Is it the depression that Dr. Lineberry? There's a whole range of things that make that crisis happen, and if you can defuse the crisis, maybe you can really help.
All right, here's another myth or matter of fact for you, Dr. Lineberry. Men are at greater risk for suicide. Myth or matter of fact?
That's a matter of fact. So men are much more likely to die by suicide if we look at our national statistics.
But
women are more likely to attempt suicide?
Based on our information about people who are seeking help, women are more likely to attempt suicide. When we look at national surveys, we find that that difference is not as marked as we thought.
507-282-1234. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call, and we will get that on the air as soon as possible. And I think we do have someone who's calling in, but go right ahead. What were you going to say, Dr. Bostwick?
I just wanted to add to the male-female distinction that there's something about what men choose to use and what women choose to use. If you jump off a building, if you hang yourself, if you shoot yourself, you're much more likely to die than if you overdose or cut yourself.
The majority of suicides are committed with a firearm? True or false?
True. Absolutely true. For both men and women.
282-1234. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Bill, you have a question?
Yes, I do, Doctor. What about the Japanese over there in World War II when they committed, I guess I'm not really good at the word, harikari?
Yes.
What's your feelings on that? I know that was in the religion, I think, or something, like to know your thoughts on that. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for the call, Bill.
The harakiri, or for example, some of the things that are happening in Islamic countries right now, or even in the U.S., some of the saints, or in the U.S., the Western world, saints who martyred themselves. We call that suicide, but it is driven by something very different from a person who is so depressed they can't stand to live any longer. The Japanese pilot who flew his plane into an American ship thought he was dying for a greater cause. The person who overdoses or shoots themselves typically can't stand living any longer. Very different phenomenon, but it plays to my point that we use this word kind of promiscuously when it can mean a lot of different things.
How can you convince somebody that they are killing for a greater cause? I mean, is that something you have to start teaching them from a very young age? Because you couldn't convince you or me that that was right, could you?
Well, I'm not so sure. We have a Christian faith built on martyrdom. I mean, this is not
love of country.
We call it love of country, throwing yourself on a bomb for the sake of others. I mean, it depends on how you slice it. But the word we say, oh, that's not a suicide. He was trying to save his buddies, or that wasn't a suicide. He was dying for a greater good. I mean, the words are funny.
507-282-1234. Rich is on the line. Good morning, Rich. Thanks for calling in. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'd just like to let everybody know about the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI. They do a wonderful job with educating people. They have walks that raise money for education and for helping those, that are suffering from all kinds of mental illness. It's just a wonderful organization. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah,
thanks,
you
Rich.
Bet. Thanks for bringing that up, and we'll put it on our website.
Sure, we will.
And Rich brings up a great point. There are a number of organizations, and NAMI does a fantastic job of working to help with understanding of mental illness, providing support, fundraising, and decreasing stigma. And as we think about that kind of tip of the iceberg, it truly is a tip of the iceberg when we're talking about suicide. We focus on it because it's the largest thing that we can see, and there's death associated with it. But there are people who are suffering with thoughts of suicide and mental illness throughout the country.
If people are listening, there's someone who is listening right now, and as Dr. Shive said, what are the words that you use? They feel like it's been nagging at them. They need to say something to a family member or to a coworker. They just weren't quite sure what they should say. What should that person do next?
You know, it takes incredible courage to actually talk about how you're feeling when you're not doing well. And so I think that first step is really to be able to talk to somebody and finding whoever that may be, whether it's friends, family, whether it's someone, a pastor or something like that, or a priest, or your family physician or anyone that way. But talking to somebody and starting that process and acknowledging that you're hurting. But there's a lot of difficulty in being able to do that. It implies that you're weak and that you're not able to manage things or manage your problems. But there is help, and actually it takes an incredible amount of courage to do that. And so that's actually a sign of courage of getting help.
All right, myth or matter of fact, people who attempt suicide and survive will not attempt suicide again. Myth or matter of fact?
I'll go with that one. That would be a myth. The highest risk period for a subsequent attempt is days to weeks to months after the initial attempt. So people will often... they will try again. And if you look at people who have died by suicide, a significant proportion of them have actually made previous attempts. If someone has that in their history, particularly recently, it's worth paying attention to.
Dr. Lineberry?
And I'll take that category for hope for 50. As Dr. Bostwick notes, that an attempt after a suicide attempt is unfortunately too common. At the same time, the idea that someone who's attempted suicide is definitively going to die by suicide is very much inaccurate. Those who, even with a very medically serious suicide attempt, have vast majority will go on and not die by suicide. But it is a significant marker, and those who have attempted suicide are at greater risk to attempt suicide in the future.
And what about copycat situations? We talk about this with teenagers or in certain populations.
This gets to one of the concerns I have, frankly, about media coverage with bullying and some of the factors that go with that, is that as we talk about, along the lines of the Harry Caray discussion, mm-hmm. That if your suicide is felt to make a difference to others or have some other meaning, that may be one factor that makes you more likely to attempt. So
but the thought is, oh, let's tell this person's story on the front page. You know, let's tell this person's story. Someone else reads it, and then that's what you're saying happens.
Well, and we've spent a lot of time with research looking at kind of the effect of media. And so we have some media guidelines with that. And it really does get to the idea of hope and that things can get better. So we want to tell people about where to get resources and help as part of that.
282-1234. Good morning, Dave. We have just a moment for your question. Go right
ahead.
Well,
there are double suicides and murder and suicide. How are they distinguished and how prevalent are they?
Dr. Bostwick?
I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but certainly there are many examples of where in a relationship difficulty, one member will kill the other than kill themselves. They're even more horrifying, I think, than individual suicides.
At a larger level, I think if we look at just patterns, what we see is that men often are more likely to murder a spouse or family members with the idea that if I can't have someone,
sure.
No one can. And then we have had very high-profile cases, obviously,
sure.
related to women with very significant postpartum depression and psychosis
right.
associated with deaths.
Sorry, Dr. Marshall.
Oh, just also some tragic examples of parents where the social system has failed them, or children, and they feel that they can't care for their child or their parent
right.
and decide that they both need to go.
Well, what we've learned, I think, is that it's important to confront the situation. It's important to talk to the person who may be thinking about suicide. And it's also important to realize that many of these suicidal tendencies can be prevented with the right help. And one of the places that you mentioned was the suicide hotline, 800-273-TALK. And thanks very much to both of you, Dr. Lineberry and Dr. Bostwick, for being with us.
We'll also put those links, lots of links, on our webpage, radio.mayoclinic.org. And if your call did not get through, please hold on the line, and we'll talk to you off air. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Coming up on next week's show, endocrinologist Dr. Ananda Basu will be here to discuss the growing problem of diabetes. We'll touch on the differences between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, who's at risk, and what can be done to treat the condition, including the status on the development of an artificial pancreas. Here's a little sneak peek.
Diabetes is a very increasingly prevalent worldwide disorder in which there is significant metabolic disturbance so that the blood sugar starts to rise. It can lead to various complications in people who have the disease, whether it is type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes. And some of the major complications include eye problems, including blindness, problems with heart attacks and strokes, increasing kidney problems, liver problems, and of course neuropathy causing nerve damage, leading to injuries, amputations, foot infections, uncontrolled diabetes for a prolonged period of time. And by that I mean over years, can really affect your body from the tip of your hair to the tip of your toe.
All about diabetes, next week on Mayo Clinic Radio. We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this show, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. You can also access a podcast of today's program there. Also, visit us at mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers share their expertise to empower you to better manage your health. You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director has been Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Tracy McRae. Thanks for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.